fun to read. This had nothing to do with it, but it got me wanting to read The Hobbit anyway, at least. Just to, like...
To, like, read a book.
Just you know, just read a book, yeah.
Cool.
Reading's fundamental.
Yeah. It's like it, Then once you get done with Tolkien, we can get you on... I can get you hooked on to Asimov.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a natural progression, of course.
Yeah, you're so young. Robert Jordan is the natural progression.
Is that the Wheel of Time, dude?
That's it. Okay. He just noticed the modern token.
Is he really?
How many? He had the Conan series before he started his Wheel of Time series. And he wrote Conan under a different name.
Wow.
Hmm.
Is it recording?
Yeah, it's...
Oh, okay.
It's hey!
Baby!
Whoa!
What is up?
Hi, this is Yahoo's with the microphone. This is Brian Scuttle.
Ryan Haynes.
And we're talking about... Well, we're going to be talking about the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes, released in 2001.
This is a very interesting opening.
Yeah. Great opening sequence. I really
like it. Not my favorite Tim Burton Danny Elfman collaboration, as far as, because I know Danny Elfman is really the one who pushes for these opening credit sequences, and it's not my favorite.
Mm-mm.
I mean, my personal favorite. I know I've run this into the ground before, but my personal favorite is the opening to the original Batman. But
yeah.
You know,
it's kind of hard to argue with that.
It's duly noted that this is our first Tim Burton movie.
Yeah,
in our first Danny Elfman movie since Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which, but yeah, Tim Burton is a personal favorite of mine. I mean, he's obviously not the world's greatest director, but he's a personal favorite.
Right now, he's not far off.
No, he's
not. I mean, he really isn't.
He isn't, but.
I mean, he's made films that, shall we say, don't work as much as others,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be watching one of them right here. But
I mean, he would deal with Batman, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
that's basically it for me.
I mean, he is truly one of the best and most original movie directors.
Yeah, not quite feeling the opening sequence.
I remember really getting a buzz off of this one when we saw it in the theaters.
Yeah.
I loved it. Loved the music. I loved, I just loved the look of it. And
we saw it in IMAX first time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We actually saw a special enhanced presentation of the local IMAX.
I think I may have enjoyed it better there.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's kind of a momentous as far as at least the music goes.
Mm-hmm.
Introduction, and made to strike fear into the heart of you somewhat, and that really worked well in the IMAX theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
William Broyles, we just saw on the screenwriting credits, who. Also include Castaway and I believe Apollo 13, memory serves.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Zanuck, who was head of Fox when the original Planet of the Apes was released and has since worked with Tim Burton on Big Fish.
Mm-hmm. So this is Mark Wahlberg coming up.
Uh-huh.
Who we saw in...
Not right
so
now.
This is Mark Wahlberg.
Right.
He changed a little bit since the last of us all.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
He absorbs himself into a role.
Something certainly happened between this and Boogie Nights.
He absorbs himself into a role. When he was offered Planet of the Apes, he was like, I'm going to become a chimpanzee. No, not really.
Yeah, clearly not Mark Wahlberg.
Does anyone know?
No, this guy's much better looking.
Who this little chimp is?
I mean, don't they have an actual name.
Did they give any backstory to, you know, the training or the anything?
What,
like
in
that?
The movie?
No.
Like
in
the extras?
Yeah.
Like behind the scenes? Oh,
yeah.
Not that I know of. I mean, it's...
Did it just go to a random zoo and pick out a chimpanzee?
No, it's your standard, you know, Hollywood trained chimpanzee.
Okay,
They touch on it a little bit, but I mean, I think more of the extras touch on, you know, the training of the actors, you know, to be as simian-like as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, that's actually some of the more interesting stuff on the extras for the DVD.
Yes, it is.
You know, watching them all go to, as they refer to it, Simian Academy, which...
And that's something that I feel come across. I don't know if we're ready to go break into the original Planet of the Apes versus this new remake, but that's actually something I saw. I noticed more here that they just seem a lot more
ape-like
here. You know, that type of detail is paid more attention to.
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. So the casting choice for Mark Wahlberg,
what was the decision behind that? Disaster.
That was never touched on in like any of the extras or the Tim Burton commentary or anything.
Well, I mean, you know, I watched one of the extras.
I mean, he's got a presence about him that resembles Chuck Heston, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, anyway, I don't know what Brian's opinion on that is. You know,
I mean, I kind of bought him in this the first time. I mean, you know. He's not quite as charismatic as Heston.
No, he is not.
And, you know, he's a little too... I don't know. I mean...
I like that one scene, by the way, where it kind of humanizes...
Humanizes?
What the... Humanizes,
your
you know...
Your grammar's about as bad as mine was this weekend.
The character...
It was horrible.
Yeah. I like that one little scene, you know, that's... That kind of humanizes, what the hell is his character's name?
Leo
Davidson. That's the one scene that humanizes Davidson's character, and the really unfortunate thing is that is the only scene that does it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really...
Well, it's actually sort of a throwback to 2001. There's a scene with a message from home with one of the astronauts in there. And actually, I mean, that... When I just now thinking about that comparison, I mean, his demeanor is not unfamiliar, completely unlike that of the astronauts in 2001. I'm not saying this is, you know, as good a film as 2001. Clearly, it's not, but you know, it's a very dry performance. And pretty static, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the casting, all I know is Mark Wahlberg basically accepted after 5 minutes because of the fact that he wanted to work with Tim Burton. And
who wouldn't?
Yeah, really.
But I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, he's got a presence about him that, you know, resembles that of you know, Chuck Heston. At one point when Jim Cameron was behind this, you know, for the 5 minutes that he was attached to it, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was, you know, considered...
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily 5 minutes for Cameron. I mean, I read a review that sort of kind of implied that he was going to be attached to this for a long time.
Which I think would have worked...
Even if just in a producing aspect.
Which I think... Probably, you know, this is nothing against Burton, but probably would have worked a little bit
better.
Well, I mean, this is the type of project you expect from Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really expect it from Burton.
That is true.
So.
With good reason.
Yeah. I mean, this project is basically in what I think a lot of Burton fans consider his dark period of this Sleepy Hollow and Mars Attacks, which I don't think is completely fair because Sleepy Hollow
hasn't
is a damn good movie.
Hasn't his entire career been just one
well,
big dark
period?
I mean creatively. You know.
I mean creatively, between like Ed Wood and Big Fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of the period where it's like he seemed more like a studio director than he was the eccentric that
right.
you know, made Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice and stuff like that.
Right. Both movies that I like.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there isn't that much science behind what happens science fiction wise. And I didn't feel too much of it in, you know, the Chuck Heston movie. I didn't see too much of it or feel much of it in the book. And I'm not, you know,
I think there's a little more science to it in the Heston version and in the book
mm-hmm.
compared to this one.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this one, some of it just kind of doesn't really make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, this was more sort of fantastical, over-the-top, you know, science fiction where I mean, they actually went time to explain it, you know, a little bit more in the Charles Heston version. I mean, you could almost kind of, it was almost real enough. This one's just like over-the-top, you know, big flash of light, not somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
I mean, the thing is, it's like, you try to explain to me what the process that takes them where they're going in the book and in the
mm-hmm.
Heston version, and I buy it.
Yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Here,
right.
I don't buy it.
Exactly.
I mean, I just sort of accept it because it's like, I know what we're headed towards.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. There's a really wonderful explanation behind it in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, the third movie in the original series. Which, if you remember, Brian, you know the whole monologue that one government official has, you know, of the, you know, the artist painting the picture of painting himself and painting, you know, I really mm-hmm. didn't, you know, if you remember that discussion and that.
Yeah, actually, I do now.
I really did think that was a wonderful explanation behind,
yeah.
you know, the, not necessarily the science of it all, but maybe the philosophical aspect
mm-hmm.
of it all. I mean, I really did enjoy that. And
yeah.
That's one of the main reasons that the third movie in the series, you know, that was made in the early 70s is my personal favorite.
Really? More than the Heston one?
Yeah. I mean, no. Seriously, sincerely, the third movie in that series is my personal favorite.
I can see that.
I mean, I know Dave just saw the Chuck Heston version for the first time this past weekend.
Right.
And he had very similar feelings to the way I felt about it the first time I saw that, which was, you know, I mean, I understood the innovation behind it and, you know, how I understood why that movie was special for it at its time, but, you know, me being, you know, the child of, you know, of, you know, the era that the Tim Burton version came out, I just automatically accepted the Tim Burton version, at least a lot more. I accepted the Tim Burton movie a lot quicker than I did Chuck Heston
mm-hmm.
movie, you know, just because I was a child of that era, I guess.
Well, I mean, also the Tim Burton version also fits more the type of science fiction action adventures we'd see nowadays.
Right.
And we've really seen since, I don't necessarily want to go back to the original Star Wars trilogy, but for a while.
Yeah.
Did you have something to say, Dave?
Oh, no, you're wrong.
Okay.
I was watching Boy Crash. Yeah, he's doing pretty good during his crashing sequence.
Yeah.
Because he's not talking. Now he's,
I mean, Mark Wahlberg.
No,
he gave him a decent role. I mean,
oh,
he's
yeah.
not a bad actor.
Yeah, I mean, he's not hideous.
I mean,
I'm not
he's done some
here.
Pretty decent stuff.
Oh,
well,
I know. I'm just,
you know.
Just
this
teasing.
Isn't necessarily going to be a highlight of his career, but.
Oh, I'm just teasing. I mean,
yeah.
you know.
I mean, this. I mean, there's nothing glaringly wrong with his performance in this movie. Besides the fact that he did it, but no.
Man.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not. It's nothing embarrassing, like, you know,
right.
like Jake Lloyd in episode one. You know, it's,
yeah.
It's,
let's not bring that up.
Well, you know,
we went.
I mean,
I ridiculed that performance during episode one.
I was gonna, you know, I was gonna not mention Star Wars at all, but you know, somebody had to.
And yet, for some reason, you did.
But you know, you mentioned it first, so.
That is true.
This is yeah. You can't deny that.
Context, though, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
Context. I do think that the Chuck Heston version is obviously better than this version.
And we really ought to be...
Unlike Ron and Dave, I actually responded strongly to the original when I first saw it, which was actually before the Tim Burton version.
Mm-hmm.
I actually saw all five of the movies during one of AMC's 30th anniversary marathon of the series. And it was at a time when I was watching a lot of classics, too, so I mean, I think that's part of it, too. But I still admire the Chuck Heston version. But I have to say, it's like, there's a critical difference, and this goes back to there's a difference in how long it basically takes to get to the apes.
Oh, yeah.
Once he gets onto the planet. And in the Heston version, it takes a long time.
As it does in the
book.
Which
it does in the book, which I actually really like. But there's also something to be said to just cutting to the chase. And
right.
I think in this reimagining of the movie, it was the only way to go, because chances are a lot of people clearly already seen the original, you know, and they know what to expect, so you just get to the chase.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's something to be said for both choices.
Mm-hmm. And we are just getting to the chase here.
Yeah.
Well, we just saw Chris Christopherson up in there.
Yeah.
And Estella Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Well, I know, Dave, you're a big fan of the Blade series.
Right. And yeah. So Chris Christopherson is actually one of my favorite actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's pretty much wasted in this movie, considering the performance that he gets in Blade.
Yeah, he's not really that necessary to have somebody like that.
Right.
Well, I just know that from listening to the Tim Burton commentary that it was his intention to have the humans, you know, at least their presence, you know, it wasn't a bad intention. It was meant to be a better intention than it came across in the movie, but it was Tim Burton's intention to have the humans more understated than we might have expected,
right.
especially with. You know, the actors that were in fact chosen, you know, including, you know, Mark Wahlberg and, you know, what's his name, Dave? The one you were just talking about, the actor.
Chris Christopherson,
forgive me for that, but, you know, it was Tim Burton's intention to have the humans, their part in the story, more understated, you know, because, you know, the big attraction, I think, creatively to filmmakers when it came to the Planet of the Apes, the original and this one as well, you know, is the thing that they, I think a lot of the filmmakers were most excited about was just the idea of great actors coming through the makeup, you know, and
yeah.
So I mean, I think considerably less attention was paid to the humans, you know, which, you know. You know, it's always been the filmmakers' intentions with all the films that, you know, that the most exciting part about this was great actors coming through, you know, great makeup.
Yeah.
That's always been I know from listening to Tim Burton's commentary that was the thing he was the most excited about, you know, and I know that was a lot, you know, from watching the Planet of the Apes documentary the AMC made, you know, that was always the most exciting part to any of the filmmakers who worked on the original series.
Yeah. And going back to a little more comparison between the original and this version, I have to say the the actual Hunt, once you get there, I actually prefer the Chuck Hessen version.
Really?
Watching it, yeah. Because, I don't know, it's a little more dramatic and doesn't seem quite as rushed.
I got you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a long
story. I mean, it's pretty good here, but, you know, it still kind of feels kind of rushed and, well, you know, it ends kind of quickly.
Mm-hmm. It does, it does. I agree with you on that one.
They did use the same line as in the Chuck Hessen movie here, except they kind of turned it around. When you say,
yeah.
You know,
get your paws off me, you damn dirty human.
Yeah.
Spoke by Michael Clark Duncan. Mm-hmm. And we've also gotten our first look at General Fade, played by Tim Roth.
Who was just, I mean, just totally, I just thought he was just one of the scariest performances.
Oh, he's really terrific in this
movie.
He is really good.
Really terrific. Best known for his work as in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction for Tarantino.
Mm-hmm. And this would be Helena Bonham Carter.
Yep.
Who we know from Fight Club.
Big Fish.
Big
now.
Fish as well.
Wings of a Dove for few of us who actually chose to watch that movie.
And her character.
And she was actually in the Mel Gibson Hamlet, too.
Mm-hmm.
Her character's kind of the first one that I noticed where the movements seemed, you know,
particularly
ape-like, you know, and try to mimic that a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, you sort of get that in the Hunt scene, too, where
right, exactly.
They're, you know, they're going on all fours.
Exactly. But, you know, that moves kind of quick.
Yeah.
You know, her being upright, the arm swinging type thing, you know, that's what I noticed first.
Yeah.
And the great Paul Giamatti.
Yep.
As Limbo.
Amazing Paul Giamatti.
As Limbo. I mean, he's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's pretty cool. Yeah, I mean,
American Splendor and, oh God, what else? Private Parts, the Howard Stern movie, and Paycheck.
If he had had a bigger part, he would probably be like my favorite character from this.
He comes pretty close to being my favorite character, period. Anyway, despite the limitations of the role.
Right. You know, I read one thing that they tried to, in order to make Helena's character work, they tried to make her attractive to you know, humans. I read that in a Tim Burton interview. But I don't know if they mentioned that in any of the documentaries. You know, her look and how they kind of try to make her in particular look attractive to.
Well, it's always been intended for there to be a flirtation between the lead
right.
human male character and the lead female ape character. That was implied in the Chuck Hessen movie. That was implied in the book,
yeah.
And that was just as much implied here. Not as strongly in the Tim Burton movie as it was in the book or the Chuck Hessen movie. But
there was always
meant
here.
To be a flirtation between the main human male lead and the main female ape lead. So
I thought that this movie.
I really feel more in this version than I do in the
do you?
Hessen.
Yeah.
Although I do feel it even more in the book.
Yeah.
You're right about that.
Oh yeah.
I do feel it more in the book. And the book, we should say, written by Pierre Boulle, who also wrote The Bridge on the River Kwai. The makeup work in this movie by the great Rick Baker.
Who, this wasn't even nominated for
wasn't no, it wasn't.
It, wa- and
it, wasn't.
It wasn't even nominated. I know Lord of the Rings won that year, right?
Yeah.
Correct? Fellowship of the Ring won for Best Makeup that year.
Yeah.
But how is this not even nominated?
Yeah, that's just a crap.
That's just...
Because of the fact that it's...
A remake?
Well, not necessarily just so much...
Politics?
Panned as a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that... Yeah.
It's a shame.
It is. It really is.
I mean, we're looking at brilliant makeup right here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, brilliant.
I mean, Rick Baker just come off The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, which he did, in fact, win for.
Yeah.
An Oscar for, but...
And he's also won in the past for Ed Wood and Men in Black. And did he do Beetlejuice for Burton?
I honestly don't
know. I can't
remember.
I want to say they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... And I'm pretty sure that won an Oscar as well.
Did it?
Yeah, for makeup.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Burton's films is, like, they're almost always nominated for... and win for technical awards. They never win for, they are never, like, nominated for, like, acting.
Well, except, well, Ed Wood.
Except for Ed Wood. Where Martin Landau, deservingly so.
Mm-hmm.
But Tim Burton really is an underrated actor's director.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised to see Big Fish not get nominated for that many things, you know, I mean...
It wouldn't have mattered this year. I mean, I'm disappointed. I was disappointed about it, but...
I was glad to see Danny Elfman got nominated for that.
Yeah.
Because Danny Elfman is actually a very underlooked, you know...
Well, he's an underrated composer because of the fact that he doesn't really do much in terms of orchestration. That's left to Stephen Bartek, who's been a collaborator of Elfman's ever since Boingo Boingo.
Well, yeah, he's the he's Elfman's orchestrator.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's always been a criticism to Elfman for that reason, undeservingly so, because, like Ron said, he is one of the more underrated ones, and he is one of the best we have right now.
Yeah, he gives a good reason. I actually listened to his. I actually listened to his Pee Wee's Big Adventure commentary not too long ago, and he gives a pretty good reason to why he doesn't orchestrate and probably why we'll never see him, you know, conducting, is that he really does prefer to be in the recording room. He really does prefer to listen to the music as it's being played, you know, like you would hear it in the theater, which I actually kind of dug that. I thought that was really interesting to hear him say that.
I can see that.
Yeah. So,
yeah, some of Mark Wahlberg's credits, Boogie Nights, The Corruptor with Chow Yun-Fat, The Big Hit, which, despite the laugh you hear from Ron, I actually enjoy it thoroughly.
I remember wasting money on that movie. That's all.
I remember that movie.
Oh, my God. Don't get me started on The Big Hit. But what was the movie that he recently did with Charlize Theron and
The Italian Job.
The Italian Job, that's
which is actually really good.
Mm-hmm.
The Truth About Charlie, which is less good.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave and I were actually talking where I was telling Dave about how it's like Mark Wahlberg's done like 3 remakes in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
This The Italian Job and The Truth About Charlie, which was remade from Charade.
Mm-hmm.
The great 1960s Cary Grant, Audrey Hepburn movie.
Who's this actor playing Ares' father?
Oh. I cannot remember.
His voice sounds so familiar.
I forget. I was looking at that. Crap.
Yeah.
This one's supposed to have a movie day to do.
I know.
That's what that's for.
Yeah.
But,
I failed this.
Yeah, there's a really wonderful flirtation between these two characters, and it doesn't feel creepy. It feels absolutely natural.
I don't know though. Some girls, you know, do my hair like that. You know,
I mean that's
totally authentic though. As far as, you know, an eighth interaction thing, so it kind of works there.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're talking.
And that was the idea.
That's what you like the girls to do. Hair. It's kind of messed up.
Well, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. They need to do this stuff. Yeah.
I like a girl who checks me for ticks. I'm sorry, I'm just a sucker for that sort of thing.
Oh man!
But
no.
Oh, was that
too much information?
Because I mean,
good God,
I don't
man!
Know where you got your ticks?
Can I just say that? I mean,
please say something.
Besides that,
oh yeah.
I was just absolutely in awe of Estella Warren's performance.
Really?
I just found her absolutely captivating. I mean, for what little screen time
she's attractive, Ron.
Yeah, that and I.
But
no,
I'm
not
captivating.
No, no,
you're
just
captivating.
I want, you know, just because, you know.
She's hot.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is.
I mean, great. It's not a horrible.
Can I explain myself?
Yes,
please explain yourself.
It's gonna, you know, the longer you guys do this to me, the longer it's gonna take for me to get out of my system. So
that's all right. We got time.
I'm just saying, like, you know, I am not a fan. I mean, Brian knows this, Dave knows this to somewhat of a degree, that I am just not a fan of devastatingly beautiful actresses, just because I just have the hardest time in the world buying their vulnerability. A lot of the times, I have this problem with Kirsten Dunst in Spider-Man, which Brian, you know, and I argue to the teeth.
Back to Spider-Man.
You know,
again.
I mean,
good
I just,
God.
But I was just impressed with Estella Warren's presence. You know, this is essentially her first big movie. I know she's done some smaller independent films. She did that dreadful Sylvester Stallone movie, Driven, you know, but I was just really impressed with her presence. You know, it's not the acting as much, just because, you know, the humans were, in fact, so understated that, you know, you just did not have time to become that, you know, involved with their part of the story. But, you know, I was just very impressed with this first-time big movie performance. I just enjoyed her. I enjoyed looking at her. I thought she was I thought she was captivating. That way, you know, the character in the book, you know, the main lead female character in the book is described as somebody of unsurpassing, indescribable, you know, exceptional beauty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the character Nova in the original Chuck Heston movie, who's played by Brian.
Linda Hamilton. Who actually has a cameo in this movie.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes. Yeah. Linda Hamilton, she captures that, and I felt as if Estelle Warren captured that just as much here. I mean, that's...
I don't think Estelle Warren is beautiful.
Do you know?
I will say, listening to your point of view on it, I see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, I think captivate is probably a bit... Maybe a little bit much,
but you know, I mean,
I do understand where you're coming from, and I mean, I do completely buy her in this role.
Yeah,
I'm
not as distracted by her beauty as you might think I would be, because a lot of times, I just have a hard time buying these kinds of roles.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to go off and, you know, but I just have a hard time buying these types of roles just because, I don't know. But I bought Estelle Warren in this role, and mm-hmm. I do think she's very beautiful, and I do think she's just as beautiful as Linda Hamilton, if not, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that's my point of view on that, and I'm not going to stick with it. Thank you, Dave. Dave's giving me the thumbs up, which in other words means, please shut up. So somebody else can talk, but
what I was watching, I guess it was the documentary for, you know, the original Planet of the Apes, and I guess the series and everything like
mm-hmm.
that. They're always talking about the message that's supposed to be
mm-hmm.
sent, and you know, it's sort of the racial message and the political message.
Yeah, the social commentary.
Right, and you get sort of the
is there a soul in there?
The racial part of it, pretty hardcore in this, but I know there's a sort of a political strain in the original movie too that you really didn't get here, you know. And I guess you know, there was, you know, I guess they kind of ran into each other a little bit too, you know, with the whole civil rights and things like that at the time. But you know, here definitely, I mean, the whole sort of racial discrimination thing is definitely beat upon a lot more, and it's probably a little bit more apparent in this movie, I think, than in the original one. For me.
The racial aspect, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's one of those things where the political aspect of it isn't so prevalent in the book as it is in the movie.
Right,
in the original movie, I should say.
Right.
And that's one of those cases where this version is actually pretty faithful to the book in those racial undertones.
Right.
Which, granted, are heavy-handed. They're heavy-handed in the original, but
they're
heavy-handed here as well.
They're heavy-handed in both. I just saw them a bit more frequently here, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
But,
yeah, you know, another thing is just the scenes of, you know, I guess the shock value for the scenes of, you know, how the humans are treated, like, you know, the sale of the little girl as somebody else's pet. You know, that was, I don't know if I saw any scene in the original that, you know, gave me the type of shock value that scene right there did. You know, I mean that scene was...
No, you don't really have one.
Right. I mean, it's not to say that's not present. You know, I mean, seeing a bunch of people being hunted down in the jungle by, you know, gorillas.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's pretty much shock value for you right there.
Yeah.
But the little girl being sold as somebody else's pet, you know, that was pretty hardcore.
Well, it's also, again, you know, laying on those racial
undertones. Right. Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
The whole idea of slavery and stuff like that.
Exactly.
So,
exactly. I'm just saying that, you know.
No, you're
that,
right.
That
it's
came
not
through
as
hardcore, you know.
The original as it is
right.
This.
You're right.
Just because you're black, isn't it, Dave?
Yeah. Trying to lay that out there. That guy does get shot, though. In the beginning,
yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah.
First one to go down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty easy. Right. There you go.
She's beautiful and she's quite good.
We haven't really touched on Abe City in this one.
Yeah, you know,
I love it.
Yeah,
I mean,
you didn't get too much of a view. I mean, besides like the chase scene, the second chase scene, I guess, and then the original, you didn't get too much of a view of, you know, sort of the life of the apes,
no.
You know, in the entire city.
And the thing is, I mean,
the ground is all shook.
And the thing is, if you read the book, I could actually when I read the book, I visualized the original,
right.
As opposed to this one.
I did,
but I absolutely love the look of this one.
Right.
Perhaps even more so. I mean, I love how, you know, it's basically, you know, it's a jungle, and you know they've made this whole civilization. This whole, you know, city out of it. It really is sort of more of a metropolis than you get a feel for in the original movie. Of course, they have a bigger budget than the, considerably bigger budget than the original movie did.
Yeah, and I like the scene. We should also touch on just how unfortunate it was that as the original series progressed, the budget just got smaller and smaller and more obvious and more obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such an unfortunate thing because...
It really is because, I mean, I know, Ron, you and I have talked about it, but, I mean, you know, and the thing is, it's like, if you were doing that series today...
Oh.
That just wouldn't be the case.
Right.
The budget would be going up and up and up, and it'd be astronomical at this point.
Yeah.
So.
And
it is really disappointing.
Yeah, and it's really obvious when you get around to like the fifth movie.
Yeah.
Where I mean, it's just a really elaborate, you know, television. Made for television movie at that point, you know, and it's just like.
I will say what it does do, it gives you an appreciation for the filmmakers of those last four movies because of the fact that, you know, and this is one of those the reasons that documentary Behind the Planet of the Apes is so important to see is because of the fact that you understand the type of conditions they were working on. And you understand how creative they were in spite of that. I mean, they still told pretty good stories. movies.
Oh, all five of them do.
Wow, we got teenage ape hangout.
Yeah.
Boys getting drunk, getting high in leather jackets. I'm not quite sure if that one worked for me. I'm not quite sure, but I guess that's done. I guess I'm down.
It worked for me. I mean, it's a little silly. But
yeah, it's this is certainly a little more contemporary
right.
in terms of its depiction of the ape culture than
that dude is nasty.
This is wow. I mean,
Lisa Marie, who is in just about every one of Tim Burton's movies since.
Yeah.
I mean, she was in Ed Wood. She was in Sleepy Hollow. And she was involved with Tim Burton for quite and up until this movie where Tim Burton met Helena Bonham
Carter. Now they have a child together.
Yeah.
Didn't he like get out of a divorce and then announce the fact that she was pregnant or something like that? Like right after.
I don't know
if it was exactly like that. Yeah, but okay. I mean, the way things are nowadays with those things. I wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.